Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto talking to you from Dallas, Texas, where once again we have an absolutely beautiful and gorgeous day. Just totally beautiful. Blue skies, just a perfect day to sit down and have a conversation with a friend from Caracas. Over the last few months, many of us have been following the news out of Caracas by reading some of the blogs and some of the websites that are in Caracas, and they've done a great job. And today we have a great pleasure to have with us one of those bloggers. His name is Daniel. Daniel, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you doing?
Doing great. What's the temperature in Caracas?
Well, actually, I'm not in Caracas. I'm in San Felipe in Yaracuy, which is about 3 hours from Caracas.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. I'm sorry.
It's always warm here, so there is no problem there. I don't have any sweater.
I'm sorry. I thought you were in Caracas, but that's okay. It's great to have you anyway. Now, over the last few months, as I said, we have been reading your blog or the one that you write for, Venezuela News and Views. When did that get started?
I did start that blog in December 2002, and I started actually posting on the web early January 2003 during the lockout strike against Chavez that year.
And you have a lot of other people that write there, or you share posts with?
No, it's really my blog. On occasion, I have a guest writer. On occasion, but it's I write at least 90% of what appears in that blog.
Well, I tell you, you have a lot of fans in the United States, so congratulations. You've done quite well. Lots of people in the United States follow what you're saying. I know one of your biggest fans is Michelle Malkin, who is also one of the biggest bloggers here in the United States. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in Venezuela this last week. Tell us a little bit about your experiences before the election, or maybe let's say the couple of weeks before. Tell us about Election Day, and then tell us what you felt like the night that the results came in.
Well, first, I would like to mention something that is actually rather important, is that I think I should go back all the way to August 15, when Chavez introduced his constitutional reform proposal. And in the next couple of weeks, I had the idea to organize a new blog to discuss specifically all of that constitutional changes and why they were so negative. So with several readers from the blog, long-time readers, we started that blog, and if I mention that, is that in part it became kind of a collective experience where we were a group of people writing together and fielding comments together and questions and debating. And really, in a way, that blog became a significant source of information in English. And I must say that my experience through that was, I sound maybe a little bit silly, but it was a certain collective experience. Because we really went through that, a group of people that tried to do whatever we could through internet to counter that proposal of Chavez. And now to get you into specifics, on the last 2 weeks, we were every day more and more concerned, because even if the polls were improving more and more in that Chavez was likely to lose the election, the campaign became every day more and more violent, aggressive, when Chavez decided to campaign as a plebiscite on his proposal, saying that whoever was going to vote no was voting against Chavez and was in fact a traitor to the cause of the revolution. So it became very tense in the last few days of the campaign.
Okay, then what we saw on television were very passionate marches. People, especially opposing Chavez, out in the streets marching. They said students. I guess it was more than students because there were lots of other people. So then take us to Election Day itself. You wake up Election Day. you went to vote, I guess. What did you sense? I mean, when you were talking to people in the streets and when you were talking to people across the country, what were you hearing? What did you feel confident that you were going to win?
I saw that we had a good chance to win. I was confident. In my own prediction, in my blog, I'm on the record on that, was that the no would win by 2%, and I hit it. I mean, I got the number. And I also did a prediction on the how would vote the different areas of Venezuela, and I got most of that right. So that was pretty good for me. I was happy in a way. But the thing is that I should go back actually to the student march that you mentioned. Because until that march, which was, if I remember well, was last Thursday, until that march, we did not know if the opposition would turn out to vote against the proposal or not. I'm not going to go into the detail what a significant amount of the opposition is pushed us to abstain, but it was very critical to get a good turnout to stop the proposal from Chavez. And that march was really exhilarating. I was not there because I'm in San Felipe, the march was in Caracas, but with another blogger, with Miguel Octavio, he went to that march and he sent me pictures and comments, and I tried to do some kind of quote-unquote live coverage. And if I mention that, because after that march, after the success of that march, I knew we were going to make it. Of course, I could not say that because people would think that maybe I'm just too optimistic, but inside I knew we did really have a really good chance. And next day, Chavismo tried to give its reply, and they failed. By Friday night, I mean, I was actually very cool on Saturday and even Sunday. I was not really too worried because I thought it was possible. It only depended on the turnout. And Sunday, my election watch on Sunday all day, was really trying to watch if the polls were filling up with people or not. That was really the concern number one on that Sunday. Well, concern number one was whether Chavez would accept an eventual defeat, but that we couldn't do anything about that. But we could do something about voting. And thanks to the students, it worked out.
Now, Sunday night, we were watching with a lot of interest here in the United States. In fact, Sunday night, I had a special interview with one of the local television stations, and they were asking me who's going to win, who's going to lose. I said, I really don't know because I don't know how reliable the polls are. I mean, I just don't know. But when I went to bed Sunday night, Daniel, I thought that Chavez had won.
Wow.
Everybody did. I mean, they were telling the world that Chavez had won. They were saying Chavez had won 51-49. So what happened? I mean, what happened after 10 o'clock?
Yeah, well, actually, that's very, very interesting because I did on Sunday, I did a day-long cover. I did a post that lasted all day long. And I would update it every hour or so. And I did report on that when it came out, and I didn't really make too much of it because I was getting all sorts of other news. And what happened is that for some reason, the Reuters news agency emitted a communique that said that Chavez had won, but the only source they mentioned was a governmental source. They didn't mention any other source. And amazingly, many of the newspapers in the world picked up on that and assumed that Chavez had won. So what happened to Reuters? How come there are two journalists in Caracas who are not more careful? That I will leave it to everybody to speculate on that. I mean, I don't want to get into that thing. But the fact of the matter is, at the very least, they did a sloppy job because all the polls were that was for a tight race favoring the no option. And during the day, especially at the end of the day, people started voting a lot. The turnout increased a lot after 2 p.m. So by 4 or 5 p.m., the exit polls that were already available were saying that the no had a good chance to win. But what did Reuters say? They cited the exit polls from the government, not the one from the opposition. I mean, for some reason, either they didn't call the opposition, they didn't check, whatever, and they just cited the governmental, supposedly exit poll from pollsters that are not well known. In other words, what Reuters did, they fell into a media manipulation by the government, which was trying to create an international opinion that that Chavez had won the referendum. And by 6 p.m., it was not clear at all he had won. Anybody with a little bit of inquiring spirit would have been able to figure out that much. I mean, we didn't know if the no had won or not, but we certainly didn't seem to see had won already.
Now, when did Chavez go on TV? At what time did Hugo Chavez go on TV and say, I lost?
Well, that is the scandal now we're dealing with, because polling closed at 4:30. And we know officially that the very last polling station, which still had people voting for X reason, closed by 9:30, 10 p.m. And we also know that by 7, 8 p.m., the electoral board had already the result. They already knew that the no had won. And yet, they waited until 1:30, almost 1:30 in the morning to announce the result, because simply Chavez was not ready to concede. And so they had to wait until Chavez finally made up his mind and was convinced that he had lost the election and he could make up some kind of speech. So it is a scandal that the supposedly electoral board, which is an independent organization, had to wait for the president to accept to give his concession speech before they announced the result. So in practical terms, we should have known the result by 8 p.m., and we had to wait until 1:15 in the morning on Sunday to finally get the result officially.
This is why, then, this explains. See, I didn't know that. You're giving me some interesting information. Now I understand why everybody in the world went to sleep thinking that Chavez had won, including myself, because I went to sleep at 10:30 Central Time, which would be 12:30 your time. And at that time, 10:30, not only the television, but even one of the more popular, you may be familiar with a website in the United States called the Drudge Report, and that's one of the more popular ones. They were saying that the early information was that Chavez had won. But anyway, that's very interesting what you just said, because that was one of the big questions I had. You know, why did it happen that way? Well, let me ask you one, I guess, a practical question. We are now where we are. What happens next? You yourself wrote something about a way of using the Constitution to remove Chavez. But let's just say right now, what happens next? Can the people of Venezuela come together and have at least 2 or 3 years of political peace so that...
No.
Okay.
No. Not at all, unfortunately. That election has not solved anything. That election has the benefit of that election. It is that it had avoided major evil. If the constitutional reform had passed, it would have passed with a squeaky margin. And it was a very strong, very harsh proposal, which would have been voted by less than one Venezuelan in three. So you can imagine that when that proposal goes into application, the two in three Venezuelans, even if they did not vote or they didn't care, when they're going to start feeling the consequences of that, you could imagine all the unrest that would come from that. So that would have been really a very bad situation within a very few months. Now, by the no victory, what we do, we gain a little bit of civility in the political dialogue, which means that for the first time Chavez lost, he finally faced with the fact that half of the country is against him, and he's either going to have to kill all of us or to start negotiating. It is really his choice. He's going to have to figure out what he's going to do about that. So we hope that he will calm down a little bit, but we doubt that very much. Actually, this morning he was having a press conference where he said, this is the president of the republic. We're saying that the opposition victory is a piece of shit. He said that in front of the international press.
He said that in Spanish, I assume, right?
Yeah, he said that. He used the word shit.
I hope the FCC doesn't come down on me for you saying that, but that's okay. I think they'll know what you meant.
That's true. I should not have said that, but well, anyway.
Well, that's
so
all right.
This is the President of the Republic saying that in front of the Army Chief of Staff and an international press conference.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, you cannot say that ever. So that tells you how unhinged he is right now, and all bets are open right now.
Daniel, go ahead. Go ahead and finish.
So in practical terms, I mean, if Chavez is going to calm down, which I think is going to calm down eventually, because his people just are going to tell him, you need to cool down some. So he is going to have to start ruling for a while, and he's going to have to think about how to do damage control, so to speak. But the problem is that next year he is going to have to increase gas price, which is a very critical political issue here. He's going to be faced with an inflation of at least 20%, and he's going to be faced with a devaluation, which he cannot postpone for much longer. And the devaluation should be at least 20 to 30% of the currency value right now. So those are very unpopular measures that he's going to have to face next year. And depending on how he faces them, he will be able to serve the remaining 5 years of his term, or he might have to leave before. So we cannot really, no crystal ball is working right now. But he's going to have a lot of trouble next year, and that's where we're going to see what's going to happen.
And we hope that over the next year, Daniel, that you can chat with us and bring us up to date. We love your blog. You have lots of fans here in the United States, people who read your blog and get information that way. I want to thank you very much for the time that you gave us today. It was extremely informative, and you're a great guy. I mean, you're doing a great job down in Venezuela, and please say hello to all of the other bloggers like you who got the word out, and we're very grateful to you. Say hello to all of them and tell them that.
Okay, I will do. Thanks
that,
very much.
That we read your stuff and you have a great day in Venezuela. Okay, Daniel?
Okay, thank you very much.
My
bye.
Pleasure. It was great talking
bye.
To you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, that bye. Was, bye-bye, Daniel. That was blogger Daniel. Daniel is a gentleman who's doing some wonderful work out of Venezuela, Venezuela News and Views, and it's just fabulous what he told us about Hugo Chavez. And I think our next guest probably has a thought on Hugo Chavez. Jack Kelly, how are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you, Silvio.
You maybe had a chance to listen there to Daniel. I guess Hugo Chavez is a very irrational human being, isn't he?
Well, he does seem to be a few degrees off plumb.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I mean, I don't know exactly what to make of him. He's something else. But anyway, we really appreciate. We're talking to Jack Kelly, military journalist and a former Marine as well. And many of us read his stuff quite often. Sometimes in Real Clear Politics and also in the Toledo Blade. And I wanted to get Jack's interpretation or thoughts on this NIE report that came out yesterday. What do you feel about that? What was your reaction to it?
Well, first, it would be great news if it's true. But that's a pretty big if. The thing to remember about the NIE is that it's a swag, a scientific wild-ass guess, not a proven fact. And it's a swag that comes from people whose predictive track record on the Middle East in general and Iran in particular has not been good, a swag which is contradicted in its most significant element by Israeli intelligence, whose predictive record has been much greater.
Explain that to somebody. I mean, explain that to me. As I understand it, the NIE report is sort of like the summary of a number of agencies. You're talking about the CIA and military agencies.
Yeah.
Explain to us how that report comes to be.
Okay. The NIE's National Intelligence Estimates are periodic reports from the intelligence community, which is headed by the Director of National Intelligence, that new clumsy bureaucracy that we established in the wake of 9/11. And it consists of the 16 U.S. Intelligence agencies, although only a relative handful had a role in crafting this NIE, which is done chiefly by three former the lead agencies in the under the overall umbrella of the Director of National Intelligence are of course, the CIA, the National Security Agency, which gathers electronic intelligence, the National Imagery Agency, which is responsible for collecting photo intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the intelligence arms of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, the Treasury Department's Intelligence Service, the FBI, and so forth.
Now, when you say that you're glad if it's true, if it turns out to be true, why? You're skeptical because they've made mistakes in the past, but it seems like, you know, a lot of people out there are saying, well, see, Bush is lying, or Bush was making this up. I mean, this has become a real political event now all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, that's the people who wish to politicize something which shouldn't be politicized. Now, 4 months ago, one of the three lead authors of this NIE, Thomas Finger, who is the Deputy Director of Analysis for the intelligence community for the Department of National Intelligence, told the House Armed Services Committee, quote, that Iran is continuing to pursue uranium enrichment and has shown more interest in protracting negotiations and working to delay and diminish the impact of the United Nations Security Council sanctions than in reaching an acceptable diplomatic solution. We assess that Tehran is determined to develop nuclear weapons despite its international obligations, international pressure. Well, that was 4 months ago, and in this NIE for which Mr. Finger is one of the three people most responsible for drafting, is a complete reversal of that.
I agree with you. How could something like that happen? Either he was totally misinformed 3 months ago, or he's totally misinformed now. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to say two such different things.
Well, it doesn't unless something else comes up. Now, what conceivably could have come up that could have changed it, our intelligence about Iran? Remember that in 2005, the NIE says with high confidence that Iran is building a nuclear weapon. And this current NIE says with high confidence that Iran stopped building a nuclear weapon, suspended its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Now, that's quite a reversal. What, you know, without getting into, you know, dark political theories, although there's some of that going on, about how this could have happened, what's the single most significant thing that's happened with regard to our ability to tell what's going on in Iran? And that's that a very big cheese within the last year, a general named Reza Asghari, defected from Iran, you know, a deputy head of the Iranian, you know, Revolutionary Guards, defected from Iran to the United States and apparently brought with him a bunch of documents. And it could be that the reversal is due chiefly to what General Asghari has had to say in his debriefing sessions and the credibility assessed to his testimony and to whatever else has been brought out. And it's also possible, remember that the intelligence community's conclusions about weapons of mass destruction in possession of Saddam Hussein were widely ridiculed after the invasion of Iraq. So it is certainly possible that, although I consider the CIA in particular to be dysfunctional, that it's improved its capabilities to gather intelligence, is aware of learning from its mistakes and having gathered some intelligence. But I suspect that if there is a strong factual base to this reversal of form, it is what General Asghari has had to say.
Now, the president of Iran is now going all over the world saying, see, you know, we won, you know, we were telling the truth all along. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have a hard time believing him. I mean, I just don't, you know, I just have a hard time believing him. Now, are they going to then now take advantage of this and go basically go full front with their bomb buildup?
Well, first, if the good news is true, the bad news about the good news is that this report was made public. You know, it's, you know, if indeed Iran did suspend its weapons program in 2003, that's very good news and it should influence our policy. But the public publication of the conclusions of the NIE, as you can see from Ahmadinejad's crowing, harms our ability to international pressure. Now, can you think of any event that happened in 2003 in the Middle East that might have influenced their attitudes?
Yeah, I do recall some B-52s flying over Iraq.
Yeah, well, if the Iranians suspended their program for the same, remember Muammar Gaddafi in Libya abandoned his nuclear weapons program at the same time in 2003 as the NIA now says Iran suspended its. And Gaddafi made no secret of why he gave up his nuclear weapons program. He told, according to the London Telegraph, he told the then Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, quote, "I will do whatever the Americans want. I saw what happened to Saddam, and I was afraid," end of quote. So if the NIA is true, this is not anything that is critical of President Bush. It's an endorsement of what he's been doing. But the ability to maintain sanctions will definitely be weakened if this comes through. Now, the NIA expressed only moderate confidence that Iran has not restarted its weapons program, and high confidence that it wants to. Now, the chief particular that Israeli intelligence differs, Israeli intelligence agrees that in 2003, the Mossad agrees that in 2003 Iran did suspend its program. But the Mossad is convinced that Iran has subsequently restarted it. And although the national intelligence estimate says with high confidence that if Iran restarts its program, it won't be able to have a bomb before 2015, the Israelis think it can have a bomb in 2009.
Yeah, well, that's pretty interesting stuff, because I'd rather believe the Israelis. I mean, they've been pretty good at stuff like this.
Well, they have a better track record in large part because their survival depends upon it. So
that's right. That's exactly right.
They take intelligence more seriously. But the leaking, the unadulterated bad news, even if this is good news, is that this was made public. It would have been far better if it hadn't been.
Now, how does something like this become public? Isn't this a CIA report?
Well, no, it's a report from the Director of National Intelligence, BNI. It's a formal national intelligence estimate. It is the conclusions, the judgments, the actual report, the analysis on which the judgments are made, the key judgments are made, is not released and shouldn't be because most or all of it is based on classified sources and methods, which we shouldn't know about, which shouldn't be made public. But I suspect, it was announced by the president the day before yesterday, but I suspect he did it because if he didn't do it, that political enemies within the intelligence community would leak it to journalists otherwise. So it would be out there anyway, and he'd look bad.
Very interesting.
So I suspected that even if the report were not written primarily with domestic politics in mind, the fact that the conclusions of the key judgments have been made public was definitely a product of political maneuvering.
Give us 2 minutes on Iraq. I know you've been writing a lot about that. Give us your 2 minute, just a couple of minutes on Iraq.
We're winning. We're winning to the point whereby Al-Qaeda is starting to abandon Iraq and send foreign fighters who were still alive there to Afghanistan, which is one reason why things are getting a little hotter in Afghanistan. And although if you look at a map, the only way that belligerents in Iraq could get to Afghanistan is through Iran, which says something else about Iranian intentions. But Iraq is no longer the central front in terms of fighting in the war on terror. That's shifted to the northwest boundary of between Pakistan and Afghanistan and in Afghanistan itself.
Well, it's always great to talk to Jack Kelly. I'm sorry that we beat your Packers a couple of weeks ago.
No, you're not. But in the game that counts,
Yeah.
Brett should be able to play the whole game, and Charlie Woodson will be back at cornerback, shutting down your loudmouth wide receivers, and could have a quite different outcome.
Oh, I agree with you. Listen, I wish that Brett had played the whole game, and I do think that interference call at the end there was a tough call against the Packers. But, Jack Kelly, thank you very much for your time. It's so much fun to talk to you. Have a great day in Pittsburgh. Is it snowing there?
Oh, you betcha. Quite a bit.
Quite a bit. All right. Well, that's...
Hawaii 2 weeks before Christmas.
All right. Well, have a great day. And if we don't chat before Christmas, Merry Christmas to you and to your family.
And Merry Christmas to you, Sylvia.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, that was Jack Kelly, of course, one of my favorite journalists, and I guess he's a blogger, too, and we always enjoy hearing from him when it comes to anything having to do with Iraq and Iran. He had some very interesting things to say about this NIE report what can I say? We're very interested indeed. I think we've got Rick Moran on. Are you in, Ron? Are you in the loop here, Rick?
I'm right here, Sylvia. How you doing?
Just doing great. Listen, I think today, you may be realizing today one of the benefits of being a blogger. You don't have
What's
to go
that?
To work.
A
in the snow. It's snowing in Chicago, right?
Only 5 inches. It's no big deal. Jeez, we're the city of the big shoulders. We shrug this kind of stuff off and just plow ahead.
Well,
now, Dallas, I could see 5 inches paralyzing that city, that for sure. But we don't, if you ever get snow, I don't know, I doubt if you do. But no, Chicago, this is nothing. This is nothing.
Well, okay, then I'll take your word for that. I mean, you're right. If it's 5 inches down here, it would literally paralyze the entire North Texas region.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we would be... I might have a chance to get to my office because I live nearby, but my goodness, most of the city, you're right, would be totally shut down. But I'm glad that you're making it there in the Windy City.
No problem.
I just spoke. I wanted to chat with you about a couple of things before we got into our conversation about the NIE and the post that you wrote. I was talking earlier today, and maybe you'll have a chance to listen to it later if you listen to the link about on the show. But I was talking to a blogger from Caracas, and he was really giving me a lot of information about what's happening down there. And apparently, Hugo Chavez had a very irrational press conference today, which should not come as a surprise to anybody, which he basically really took on the opposition and so on. And then this blogger was telling me that next year, Hugo Chavez faces some very difficult economic circumstances. He's going to have to make some very tough economic decisions regarding the devaluation of the currency and so on. You wrote a post a few days ago in which you were surprised, or you were saying something about the way the left was treating the election, almost like saying, well, you know, Chavez is this great Democrat who accepted results. Do you recall that? Do you have any thoughts on Chavez?
Well, he's not done. I mean, he's going to get those. He's got 4 years to get those quote reforms unquote passed, one way or another, by hook or by crook. I have absolutely no doubt. In 6 months, he'll probably have most of them. And as far as the referendum on whether or not he could, you know, serve another term, he might just have his lackeys in the parliament pass a constitutional amendment for that. I mean, he could always do that too. No, I'm pretty sure that the opposition had better get its act together. I mean, they've been pretty much steamrolled by Chavez for the past, 10 years. And now, though, apparently there have been some real defections from the Chavez camp. This Gaudel guy, the General Gaudel, the former defense minister, he probably saved that election on Sunday night. The results should have been announced, no matter how close. It's done all electronic voting. It was done. Everything was connected to the CNE, which is the electoral headquarters, the so-called Independent Electoral Commission, which was controlled by Chavez, and the vote should have been announced around 7 o'clock that night. So that when 11 o'clock rolled around and the votes and not a word from the CNE, This General Goodell fella goes before the cameras and demands that the CNE release the vote. And right about that point, evidently this is CNN International who covered this. Some opposition dignitaries were at the CNE, and they tried to get a look at the votes, you know, see what it was, and they were stopped by Chavez police and army people, telling them, "Well, you can't see it. The violence is too bad. It is too bad right now." That's what they told them. So the fellow Goodell evidently saved the election because within an hour or so the results were announced. And you know, the point is this: that this is the moderate left. This is the Democratic left that we're talking about here. Goodell, a few other of the defectors from the Chavez regime, as well as some other moderate leftists who had been supporting Chavez, but now apparently might go over to the opposition and join forces with them. If that were to happen, that would be very, very encouraging, because what the opposition needs more than anything else is credibility. And if it's just a bunch of old rich men, you know, who have been robbing the country blind for 150 years, you know, it doesn't have very much credibility. But you get the Democratic left involved, and I think that would really be a spur for the opposition to get organized.
Yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that. The second thing I wanted to ask you, you have a very interesting, I saw on your blog today, you have a very interesting show coming up today, a very interesting guest, the fellow from Europe. Tell us about that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, actually, the show was yesterday. The show was yesterday.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was yesterday. Okay.
Yeah, you can get the
you can listen
podcast
to it. Okay.
Already.
Yeah. Yeah,
I've got the streaming. You can stream it right on my site, rightwingnuthouse.com. Yeah, Michael Vandergalen, or Michael Vanderwallen. Quallen. I don't quite remember how he pronounced it. Vanderwallen. He's like swallowed the L's. You know, he's Dutch, you know, what can you say?
Sounds like somebody from Minnesota, you know, with that name.
Yeah,
like that.
Well,
right?
He was fascinating. We got into a great discussion about Russia, and why NATO might not expand now, because the countries in Europe most likely to join, like Poland and the Czech Republic and places like that, are intimidated by Putin. They don't want to get Putin mad at him. I mean, this Putin, there's no doubt that the Russian election showed that Russia is back. If not militarily, I mean, I've read reports at strategypage.com that poo-poo the Russian military, pretty much saying that they're probably 10 years away from even getting, to be a decent military, thanks to the fact that all during the 90s, their equipment and the training and everything else just went to hell because there was no money, you know. But, yeah, we talked about Russia, we talked about NATO, we talked about Belgium. Belgium, which is, as we speak, flying apart. Well, there might not be a Belgium in another couple of years. It might be a place called Flemish something and a place called Walloon something. Who knows?
Yeah, that's interesting. What did he say, like, about, when you talked about NATO? Interesting question that I would have asked, and maybe you asked him too. And that is, I've heard that Canada next year, in February of 2009, Canada is going to pull out of Afghanistan. And they're doing a great job, by the way. The Canadians are doing a great job. They're fighting. They're taking casualties. But if Canada pulls out of Afghanistan, that's going to mean the U.S. and Great Britain are the only ones doing the fighting. I mean, how long is NATO going to hang around when people don't want to fight, in any of these wars?
Well, that's the whole problem with Afghanistan right now, is that we got plenty of troops there. It's just not the only ones fighting are America, Great Britain, Canada, and Holland. Holland is also fighting. You know, the Dutch are fighting as well. and it's crazy. There was a Canadian general last year, or so, I think it was last year. He's second in charge, second in command in Afghanistan. He said, talking about Germany and France especially, he said, how many troops do you need to guard the airport? That's all they wanted to do. That's all the Germans and the French want to do, is these non-combat roles, and let the Americans and the Canadians and the Brits do the hard fighting, you know? I don't know what the, you know, NATO, I mean, the same thing happened in Kosovo and of course, in Bosnia, where the Europeans love to come in when things are nice and quiet and organized, and then they can just sit in their barracks and, you know, and walk around town in their uniforms picking up local girls, you know. That's the French and the German idea of what an army is for, you know. And the problem in Afghanistan is we have plenty of soldiers, but they're not fighting, and we need them to fight. We need them to fight, and I don't know how you get them to do that.
Well, I told my friend in Canada that if, in fact, and it's a big if, because I don't know whether Prime Minister Harper will walk away. I mean, I think he's more committed to the fight. But I think if the Canadians walk away from Afghanistan, at some point American public opinion is really going to get very angry at the fact that the United States and, let's say, the British, we're the only ones doing all the fighting. I mean, and all these other countries are depending on us. I mean, they want to be under our umbrella, but when it comes time to fight for something, these countries do not want to fight. And at some point, American public opinion is going to turn on that.
Yeah.
If it hasn't already.
The problem with the French and the Germans especially is that they live in pretty much left-wing socialist countries. And the problem is if they lost one soldier in Afghanistan, they'd have 100,000 people in the streets the next day calling for a withdrawal. You know, when I talked to Michael, he said, we had a couple of people killed in Afghanistan in an accident, in a car accident, and there were 20,000 people in the streets the next day in Holland calling for the troops to come home.
Well, yeah, and of course, Al Qaeda or the Taliban was actually targeting Canadians, hoping that would turn public opinion back in Canada. But anyway, I mean, I think it would be a huge mistake for the Canadians to pull out. They're doing a great job. I mean, let me congratulate them. They're doing a great job. I was not aware of Holland also doing fighting. That's good to hear. But at some point in time, we got to get more people on the field than just Americans and Brits. I mean, at some point in time, we need the West to fight to defend the West. Let's get into this NIE report. I read your post yesterday. I didn't have a chance to see your site today, so I don't know if you've written an update on it. You have a very interesting take on it. Why don't you tell us?
Well, I'm not with evidently most of the people on the right who think it's some kind of a conspiracy of some kind. Whether, you know, first of all, it was put out by the administration. It was put out, take your pick, for the following reasons. One of the following reasons. One, it was going to come out anyway. If they tried to keep it secret, the cabal of leakers in the intelligence community that are opposed to the Bush administration would have made sure it got into friendly journalists' hands anyway. Or two, the Congress would have forced them to release it because of the explosive nature of the explosive nature of the findings. You know, Iran, no nuclear program since 2003, supposedly. But the Israelis don't believe that, by the way. I don't know if you read that today. Israelis came out and said,
no,
they may have stopped, but they've started again. That's what he's saying. And I that's entirely possible.
So
you can take your pick about why it's happening. My own personal belief, and I'm writing a piece today. I haven't written anything for my blog today yet. I was too busy with other stuff.
You were shoveling snow.
No. I was working for my other boss, Tom Lipson, over at the American Thinker. I'm associate editor over there. And I was working on his blog over there. Plus, I was doing stuff for Michelle Malkin, who's my other boss. Michelle, I'm comment moderator over there, and I was doing my job over there for a while. So,
by the way, those are two great sites. I love American Thinker. They have some great stuff on that site.
Absolutely. Some fine writers, fine contributors, including me. I haven't contributed anything to that site in about 3 weeks, a month maybe. It's terrible. I just have no time to write for myself anymore. Anyway, what I am writing today is that Bush himself was the catalyst behind releasing this report. And the reason is kind of complicated. I think he's actually declaring independence in a way. Excuse me for a second. I got him.
We're talking to Rick Moran from the Windy City, and Rick is taking a little break right there. We've all been in that situation before. So.
I was just saying,
Rick, while you were on hold there, I was saying that we're talking to Rick Moran out of the Windy City, and we all understand what Rick is just going through right now. So.
Well, I actually swallowed some soda wrong. You know,
okay.
I hate doing that.
Yeah, right. Okay. We're
at any rate,
back to your Bush theory.
Yeah. This is kind of a declaration of independence from Bush. This is the point I'm making. Bush has been moving away slowly from the Cheney faction in the White House, and there is a Cheney faction. So, you know, call them neocons, call them war hawks, call them call them anything you want. I think they're idealists myself. I think they're and the worst thing you can have in government at times, and sometimes, is an idealist. And I think Dick Cheney has proven that, that this is one of those times. At any rate, so Bush has been moving away from the Cheney faction ever since he got rid of Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. And basically, here comes this NIE down the road that is just 180 degrees change in our policy. I mean, it's going to, you know, we're not going to get any kudos for it, by the way. We're not going to get any congratulations from people. But what it's doing is, it is rearranging the world, basically. We're probably not even going to be able to get another round of sanctions through on Iran. It's a toss up whether we can keep the sanctions we've got on now. And this is despite the fact that Iran had a program until 2003 to build a nuclear weapon, and that once they perfect the fuel cycle in making highly enriched uranium, you know, then all they have to do is just reactivate those dormant parts of the program, and they'd have a bomb in 6 months. Okay, that's basically what the NIE has been saying. Said, you know, is that the problem there? But the problem is that they're having enormous problems with their fuel cycle research and development, and it's just not going very well. Which is fine with us, you know. Couldn't you think about it? But the point is that Bush had this released as a way to make a total break with the Cheney faction. Not that he's not going to listen to Cheney, and not that he's not going to take his advice on occasion. But certainly he is no longer in their corner on foreign policy issues. And I think this NIE proves that.
Interesting, interesting theory. There's one thing you wrote, one sentence here that you wrote that I underlined about this report. It says, it's quote, its main point that Iran halted its dual-use program in 2003 appears solid. It does its warning that we don't know if that is still true today.
Right.
So I mean, in a sense, all we know is that in 2003 they stopped it, but we don't really know much about it today. I mean, am I correct in saying that?
That's correct. In fact, they have a high confidence, which is the top level intel seal of approval. They have a high confidence that they stopped in 2003, but only moderate confidence that they didn't pick it up again at some point.
So let's see. Let's do the weather report. Let's the NIE do a weather report saying we know that it won't snow this afternoon, but we're not sure that it'll snow tonight. I mean, is that kind of what this is? I mean, it's rather confusing. I don't know about you, but I agree with you. I don't think it's a conspiracy that this stuff came out, but I'm still not confident that we've got our hands, our arms around this situation in Iran.
Oh, no, not by a long shot. In fact, that's, you know, the nature of these things, my understanding, this is what the sixth or seventh that I've really studied or tried to study and read everything I could about. The amazing thing about these things is that they are so general. They are generalized. You know, the specific thing about the Iran not having a nuclear program, that's actually very rare in these things. You know, at least as far as my reading of them goes. As far as your snow analogy, let me try this. 90% chance of snow this afternoon, with a 50% chance of snow tonight.
Okay, well that's better. I knew you could improve on my analogy. That's why I said it, because I knew you could improve on
because
my
because I think
analogy.
That's the way that they do it by percentage. You know, like a 90. We have a 90% confidence in this source. And evidently the source, the major piece of intelligence that they got that convinced everybody was an intercept, a call, an intercept phone call between a very well-connected Revolutionary Guards general and another general in the Army. And evidently they mentioned the fact that the program had been dismantled in 2003.
That's interesting, which, of course, something very interesting happened in 2003. That's the other theory that is out there, that the fact that it ended in 2003, by coincidence, that was the year we took out Saddam, and that was the year that Gaddafi also gave up his program. So maybe that's the way this thing will eventually play out. I don't know. I mean, it's very confusing. It's very confusing. And now, some people think that this could actually increase the possibility of a military attack in the sense that Iran will get very, very cocky now. And Iran will come to the conclusion that they got away with it, so let's now, let's go ahead and build a program because the United States is not going to be able to do anything about it now. What do you think of that theory?
If they do, we probably won't know it until they're almost finished with it or until they announce it, which they never will do.
Until they do a nuclear test, basically.
Yeah, well, North Korea was stupid. If North Korea had just gone up right to the edge of being able to test a nuclear device and then shut everything down and put everything in mothballs, which is basically, by the way, what Japan has done. We think that Japan right now has, in various sites, enough highly enriched uranium, if not plutonium, and a good bomb design, that they could probably construct, you know, several dozen nuclear weapons within a matter of weeks. Because they're very big in nuclear power, and this is the way most countries probably would go. This is the way South Africa did it. South Africa did have a nuclear program. They did have like 12 nuclear weapons, and what they did. They did eventually test one in the middle of the Indian Ocean that people kept denying was a nuclear test. I don't know if you remember, it was a big to do back in the I think it was late 80s, right at the end.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, there was a big
people,
commotion.
No, it was
about
a meteor. It was a meteor that hit the ocean, or no, it was lightning or something.
Yeah, pretty big meteor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially since nobody saw it coming down.
Yeah. And it was done just when our spy satellites had gone past, so there was no way, pretty sure that it was, anyway, it turned out to be a South African nuclear test. But they got all the way to the edge of building a bomb and stopped. So there are ways to do it where your opponent would never know that you're within a couple of weeks of having a bomb.
That's what's scary about all of this. And,
oh, yeah.
And, I mean, that's what's scary about this. We're dealing with such irrational people that's what's really scary about all of this. But anyway, let me get just change gears a little bit and ask you, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you a quick question. What do you make of what's happening over in the Democrats between Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards? Seems to be getting closer in Iowa, your neighbor there. What are you hearing about that?
It's also closer in New Hampshire. Look, I think it's a reflection in both the Republican and the Democratic parties that this race is tightening up. And it's basically that people don't like the choices that they're being confronted with. They don't like, you know, Hillary Clinton has some passionate people behind her, but, you know, she's also got 44% of the country who will never vote for her under any circumstances. 44% have said that.
That's a pretty good place to start.
That's an amazing number when you think about it. And it really makes a victory on her part very, very difficult. She's got to convince basically 56%. She's got to convince 56% of the country. I'm sorry. She has to convince like 70% of the country that's left out of after the 44% are taken out. She's got to convince 70% of them that she's the one. It's a very tough job for her. But no, I think it reflects just a dissatisfaction with the candidates. Nobody likes them. I mean, think about it. There's so many negative things you can say about Hillary and Giuliani. There are bad things you can say about Obama, the worst being he's just an empty suit with no ideas and no, you know, nothing. John Edwards, I mean, come on. Give me a break. We're really going to put a trial lawyer in the White House? Give me a break.
You, of course, he was a state senator there in Illinois. What was he known for as a state senator? I mean, was he...
Nothing. I'm trying to think of the primary he ran in. The general election he ran in, he ran against what's her name? Jerry Taylor's husband. I can't remember his name. Jerry Taylor, 7 of 9 on the Star Trek Voyager. Her husband and evidently they had a horrible divorce, and it turned out that he did some weird sex things with her, and it's just terrible.
Oh, was this the guy who used to be the governor of Illinois?
No,
Jack Ryan, right? Was it
Jack Ryan? Jack Ryan, right? Exactly, Jack Ryan, and he used to he's just a big businessman, a real estate magnate, you know, just had a ton of money, and it was just ruined the Republicans. The Republican Party's in shambles in this state anyway, so it doesn't matter. But Obama didn't run against anybody. He didn't. He didn't do anything in the state capital except be a liberal. And what did he do when he was there as a senator? Nothing. I mean, the guy is an empty suit. Who talks nice? Who talks well? That's about it.
Yeah, that's about it. But it's an interesting thing happening in the Democrat primary. I don't know how it's all going to shake out, but certainly the inevitable Hillary nomination is not as inevitable as it may have been 3 or 4 months ago. Rick, we're going to have to wrap it up. As you know, the time is out, but I want to thank you very much for participating and giving us your input on the NIE. We love your blog. We check it every day. It's just great. It's just so much fun reading and talking to you. And are the Cubs going to make any deals? I mean, I know that the Tigers made a huge deal of days ago. But
I think the Cubs wanted Cabrera, or the Sox, I'm sorry. The Sox wanted Cabrera, but that's no more. Oh, well.
Yeah, the Tigers, I mean, they just picked up two of the better Marlins. So it seems like four of the big players there in the Marlins 2003 World Series team have been traded to the Tigers and to the Red Sox. So
Red Sox,
if you're a Marlins fan, that's got to make you feel great.
Oh, sure.
I mean, you got to feel great about their future. But thanks a lot for participating. On Friday, by the way, I'm going to have a discussion on not necessarily on illegal immigration, but I have a fellow who's written an article here in the Dallas Morning News indicating that there are less people trying to come over because apparently it's becoming more and more difficult to come over the border, and Mexicans are just saying, the heck with it, we're just not going to go over. So
right.
It's an interesting interesting article. I mean, it's an interesting idea, and if you get a chance, listen to it. I'll send you the link. It's a very interesting guy.
Okay.
But thank you very much for your time. Thank you, and have a great day here in the Windy City. Don't get too snowed in.
Okay, Sylvia. Take it easy.
Thank you. Have a great day. We love talking to you. Well, that was Rick Moran. Of course, he has a blog, Right Wing Nut House, and we enjoyed checking that. And interesting fellow, as you can see, has a lot of interesting information. So we kind of went around the table today, had a whole show, a full show, and I hope that you enjoyed it. We spoke with blogger Daniel from Venezuela, and he gave us a lot of information about that. But what is happening down there, some really, really good information about what is happening in Venezuela. Then we spoke with Jack Kelly, who is obviously very well informed on issues of Iraq and Iran. Then, of course, with Rick Moran, he's writing about that as well. So that's going to wrap it up for Wednesday, December 5th. On Friday, December 7th, as I indicated, we're going to be talking about Mexico. Not about Mexico itself so much, but about the border and the fact that it appears that more and more people are simply giving up on coming to the United States. More and more Mexicans are simply saying, look, it's not worth it. It's too much hassle to try to cross the border. It's too much of a hassle to find a job. We're just going to stay. So in Mexico, it's an interesting article, and we'll be talking to the fellow who wrote it on Friday. Well, I look forward to seeing all of you, talking with all of you on Friday, December 7th. This is Silvio Canto saying goodbye for Wednesday, December 5th. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you later.